This is the podcast from JNS Pediatrics. Welcome to the podcast from JNS Pediatrics for June 29, 2012. I'm Natalie Pincham. I will be reading a summary of some of the articles published today. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are oncology and hydrocephalus. Primary cerebellar histiocytic sarcoma in a 17-month-old girl. A case report by Kiyoshi Gomi and colleagues. The authors report a case of histiocytic sarcoma in a pediatric patient who presented with a solitary tumor in the cerebellum. The tumor was assumed to arise from the leptomeninges of the cerebellum. The 17-month-old girl presented with a 2-week history of progressive gait disturbance. Brain MRI revealed a well-demarcated solitary mass in the right hemisphere of the cerebellum, initially suggestive of medulloblastoma, ependymoma, or anaplastic astrocytoma. The patient underwent subtotal resection of the cerebellar tumor. On intraoperative inspection, the tumor was easily hemorrhagic and intensively adherent to adjacent dura mater, preventing its total resection. From histological and immunohistochemical findings, histiocytic sarcoma was diagnosed. The patient subsequently received chemotherapy, and her preoperative neurological symptoms improved. Her general condition has been stable in the 16 months since surgery. Primary histiocytic sarcoma in the central nervous system usually demonstrates an aggressive clinical course and is currently considered to have a poor prognosis. The possibility of this rare tumor should be included in the differential diagnosis of localized cerebellar tumors in the pediatric age group. Diffuse intrinsic pontine tumors, a study of primitive neuroectodermal tumors versus the more common diffuse intrinsic pontine gliomas. A laboratory investigation by Alexandra Soufit and co-authors. One predominant discussion among neuro-oncologists and neurosurgeons is the necessity of performing biopsies in cases of diffuse intrinsic pontine tumors. In this article, the authors stress the importance of obtaining biopsy specimens of these tumors for diagnostic, treatment, and research purposes. The tumors in this study, as well as other prior studies, have shown that a portion of what were thought to be gliomas were genetically more similar to primitive neuroectodermal tumors. Because the treatment of these two tumor types differs in important ways, the authors argue for biopsy in patients with diffuse intrinsic pontine tumors, especially the very young. Primary intracranial beta-human chorionic gonadotropin-producing leiomyosarcoma in a 2-year-old immunocompetent child. A case report by Brian Christopher Kelly and co-workers. Leiomyosarcomas are rare. They are associated with HIV and Epstein-Barr virus infections or other immunocompromise. Most leiomyosarcomas in the central nervous system result from metastatic disease or radiation exposure. Primary intracranial leiomyosarcomas are exceptionally rare. Most reported cases have occurred in immunocompromised patients. The authors here describe a primary intracranial leiomyosarcoma producing beta human chorionic gonadotropin, or beta HCG, in an immunocompetent 2-year-old boy. He had no evidence of HIV or Epstein-Barr virus infection, radiation exposure, or other immunocompromise. The patient presented with multiple small non-tender frontal masses, as well as a distinct superior vertical gaze palsy and slight strabismus. CT and MRI revealed multiple large intracranial masses with extracranial extension. There was no radiographic evidence of metastatic lesions or an extracranial tumor source. The patient underwent subtotal resection of the large right frontal mass. Pathological analysis revealed a high-grade sarcoma, primarily leiomyosarcoma. The elevated serum beta-HCG was attributed to the scattered cells immunoreactive for beta-HCG within the tumor, a rare phenomenon associated with ominous outcomes. There is no standard treatment for primary intracranial leiomyosarcoma. The prognosis is considered poor despite postoperative radiotherapy and chemotherapy. Faced with this grim prognosis, the family in the present case declined further therapy, including chemotherapy. The boy died 3 months later because of disease progression. Image-guided cerebrospinal fluid shunting in children. Catheter accuracy and shunt survival. A clinical article by Michael Levitt and colleagues. Shunt failure rates are extremely high. Upwards of 30% of shunts fail within the first year of insertion. The authors undertook a retrospective review to determine whether the use of stereotactic proximal catheter placement improved accuracy and led to improved shunt survival. In this study, small ventricular size did not affect the shunt failure rate, even after controlling for shunt insertion technique. Despite smaller average ventricular size, the accuracy of catheter placement was significantly improved with image guidance. Shunt accuracy did not affect shunt survival. The use of image guidance improved catheter tip accuracy compared with a standard technique, despite smaller ventricular size. Failure rates were not dependent on shunt insertion technique. An observed selection bias towards using image guidance for more at-risk catheter placements showed failure rates similar to initial surgeries. A prospective trial of pediatric shunt technique may account for differences in patient variables and further define the effect of image guidance on shunt survival. Long-term outcome for endoscopic third ventriculostomy alone or in combination with choroid plexus cauterization for congenital aqueductal stenosis in African infants. A clinical article by Benjamin Curtis Wharf and co-authors. Treating infant hydrocephalus due to congenital aqueduct stenosis via endoscopic third ventriculostomy, or ETV, has a high rate of failure. In the present study, the authors specifically examined the long-term efficacy of ETV with or without choroid plexus cauterization, or CPC. The study included 35 consecutive infants younger than 1 year of age with congenital aqueduct stenosis, uncomplicated by any other potential cause of hydrocephalus. These patients were treated during two distinct treatment epochs, with 12 undergoing ETV alone at a mean age of 4.7 months and 23 undergoing combined ETV-CPC at a mean age of 3.5 months. Time to treatment failure was analyzed using the Kaplan-Meier method. Log rank and Gehan-Breslow-Wilcoxon tests were used to determine whether differences between the groups were significant. The respective mean and median follow-ups were 51.6 and 48 months for the ETV group, and 31.2 and 26.4 months for the ETV-CPC group. Treatment was successful in 48.6% of the patients who underwent ETV alone, and in 81.9% of the patients who underwent ETV-CPC. The difference between the groups was very significant, and the hazard ratio was 6.42. Combined ETV-CPC is significantly superior to ETV alone for infants younger than 1 year of age with congenital aqueductal stenosis. The fact that the outcome for ETV alone was accurately predicted by the ETV success score supports the reliability of the ETV-CPC outcome. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter, and please like us on Facebook at Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group.